Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today we're talking about the Menendez brothers case from California. Lyle and Eric Menendez have served 35 years in prison for the 1989 murders of their parents. They were sentenced to two consecutive life sentences without parole. But now they're talking and asking Governor Newsom for clemency or pardons, and they're also seeking other routes to freedom. Judge Gale, this is a case that sort of has gone on as long as some of our legal careers have. The murders occurred in 1989. There were two trials, if I remember correctly, 1994 that ended in a hung jury, and then in 1996. The defense at the original trial was that the boys murdered their parents in self-defense because the father, Jose Menendez, was a sexual abuser of Eric Menendez. The state's position was that the boys killed their parents to inherit their fortune and their estate. Two consecutive life sentences without parole was pretty daunting for two young men who were under 26 years of age when they were convicted. Now there's been a new Netflix docudrama that's come out recently called Monsters, the Lyle and Eric Menendez story. And it has prompted all kinds of new conversation and new discussion. And these young men, after 35 years in prison, may see the light of day, so to speak, by Christmas.
Indeed. And I'll tell you, first I have to begin by saying I remember, well, maybe about 6 or so months ago, I was invited as an analyst to appear on Court TV. And I recall there being a discussion with myself and the host, Vinnie Politan, and the other panelists about this same story. And at the time, it was maybe Rosie O'Donnell who was raising the question or the issue of whether or not these brothers should potentially be released from prison because they had begun writing to her about their experiences and what brought them to the point of murdering their parents, which ultimately resulted in their conviction. If you'll recall, there wasn't really a question as to whether or not they committed the offense. It was the mitigating circumstances and the defense that they used in response to it. And I remember being on Court TV, highly skeptical all of this and highly skeptical of the fact or the idea that these two who'd been convicted long ago and were now serving these life sentences would ever see the light of day and that whatever it is they shared with Rosie O'Donnell was, you know, worth no more than just ink on paper. Because it would go nowhere. And so insofar as we have this platform and we're using it, I want to say publicly I was wrong. And I realize I was wrong now for a number of reasons. One of the biggest reasons I believe that has truly come to bear in this case, which it goes to the point of Tom, when we know better, we do better, is the fact that, as you stated in the opening, Eric Menendez was determined to be the victim of sexual abuse at the hands of his father. It's unclear as to what role, if any, the mother played in that abuse, except that perhaps she was expected to be a protector and had not been. And just recently, I was teaching to the parish judges on the island of Jamaica, and we were discussing this issue of trauma and what happens to the adolescent brain when it is traumatized and what happens. And quite frankly, that was the experience of both Eric and Lyle Menendez in the home with their parents, realizing that this abuse had actually gone on for a long time. And in fact, their father was, I'm not certain if you recall, their father was actually an executive at RCA Records. He was very well known, very well liked. Right. And that was the fortune that the prosecutors allege the boys were angling to inherit, almost like what we call in the law, the murdering heirs, right? They would be the murdering heirs. And instead—
Sounds like a PBS mystery, doesn't it?
It does, right? It does. It's definitely not a Hallmark movie.
No, let's be clear.
But definitely. But what happened here is during this time, it also came to light actually more recently than not. And actually, it may have been mentioned, but not very, very well focused on during the trials that these young men faced, was that during contemporaneous with their experiences, I believe it was Eric Menendez actually wrote a letter to his cousin. And in this letter, contemporaneous with the experience, so as it was happening to him, wrote the letter to his cousin detailing the sexual abuse and the experiences that he was having in this home. All of this was happening, and very little, if any, credence was given to the fact that these boys were traumatized and the effect that this trauma has on the child victim and how courts should be responding to, treating, and sensitizing the environment to traumatized child victims. I would go to, as far as to say that Eric and Lyle Menendez did not receive the benefit of any of this. And even to date, the prosecutors now understand and appreciate how important it is and how important it was then, and the failure of that, not to mention the evidence related to disclosing to the cousin what was happening, and so much so that the prosecutors have now requested that the Menendez brothers be resentenced and that that resentencing take into account all the time that they have served such that they can be released.
Hold on. Hold on. You're getting further down the track than we should be right now.
This is a really interesting story to me.
It is. We have three legal concepts I think we need to get across to our audience. You know, our role is to translate, and we're using this case as a basis to translate. There are three attempts to release the Menendez brothers. One is a motion for habeas corpus, and we'll talk about that. We'll talk about each of these. The second is a motion for resentencing. And the third is a request for clemency or a pardon. So I want to, Judge Gale, go through each one of these. The hearing on the habeas corpus is scheduled for November 25th. And I'll have you define habeas corpus in just a second, but what the defense is doing here is they're saying that there needs to be a new trial, that there has developed new evidence that was not presented at the trial. Now, one of the pieces of new evidence is that a person from the boy band Menudo, says that he was sexually abused by Jose Menendez, the father. So that gives credibility to the sexual abuse claim. He did not come forward at the time because Jose Menendez held their music contract with RCA, their recording contract. So that's one piece of new evidence. The second, as you mentioned, Judge, the cousin, there was a letter to the cousin from Eric Menendez detailing the sexual abuse that he received from his father. The cousin testified at trial, but they did not have the letter. So there wasn't corroborating evidence to the cousin's testimony, which allowed the jury to disregard it or to not give it as much credibility as they should, as long as the letter was absent. Well, the letter has been found. And so now they have the letter, plus the testimony from the Menudo band member.
The Menudo band member.
Menudo,
yeah.
I'm sorry, band member. Both
you just
of those,
have to be a girl that knows boy bands.
There you go. Both of those, though, go to a motion for habeas corpus for a new trial. So talk about habeas corpus. What is the concept behind it?
And so in maybe layman's terms or in general plain English, a motion or writ or a request for habeas corpus essentially is a request to the court that asks to let the body go, meaning to release the body. It's directed at someone who is either detained or arrested and is asking the court to bring that person to the court or before the judge for a very specific reason. That specific reason is to secure the person's release, meaning, again, the corpus or the corpse, the body, releasing the body, hence habeas corpus, releasing the body. And under the grounds that, or under the argument that detaining them or holding them is currently unlawful, and unless the court makes a determination that keeping them or holding on to them, that there's a lawful basis to do that, that is founded or grounded in the law, that person should in fact be released, or that person should be let go, or they should be returned to society unencumbered by detention or any other requirements. So that's essentially what habeas corpus or a writ or a motion for habeas corpus seeks to do. It seeks to ask the court to please bring the person before it and to have the hearing or to make a determination based on evidence or information that holding the body or the person is no longer lawful, or detaining them or arresting them is not lawful, and therefore they should be returned or released back to society, even if a matter may still be pending. And it doesn't mean that that marks the end of a case. It means, again, that it's just a specific ask about what to do with the person during that particular part of the case. Does that make sense, Judge?
It makes perfect sense, but I want to add one more thing, and check me if I'm incorrect on this. Habeas corpus is used a lot by prisoners, especially prisoners that have been given the death sentence. Once your appeals run out and you've exercised every right to appeal that you have, and your appeals are gone, and you're sitting in prison, the only way to resurrect your case, really, is by requesting habeas corpus. to request that your body be released, as the judge indicated, and that you be brought back into court. And that can be for all kinds of reasons, new evidence, maybe somebody lied at the trial, or jury tampering, whatever the reason. But it is another step beyond the normal appellate process. Everybody convicted of a crime has a right to at least one appeal. And that goes to an intermediate level court of appeals. After that, it's discretionary whether various Supreme Courts, U.S. Supreme Court or state Supreme Court, would take your case. However, once your appeals have been, you're finished with them, then you can still raise habeas corpus. And so it's used in a lot of death penalty cases and cases just like this, where somebody has been incarcerated for decades.
If somebody's been incarcerated for decades, then absolutely they can appeal to the court to, again, have their body released or to be brought back before the court, again, as one of those last resort appeals or last resort requests that's made to the court in order to have the matter reviewed yet again and to have a determination made as to whether or not they should remain behind bars or detained or to continue to be incarcerated, or if the court should make some different determination or some different decision that which could include releasing them and releasing them maybe even with conditions, or outright releasing them, again, even if that matter's pending, or as Judge Tom said, if there's new information or new evidence or something has been brought to the court's attention that the court may not have been aware of before, gives the court an opportunity to review and digest that evidence while it makes a final decision. So habeas corpus is a mechanism in the law that can be used to essentially grant freedom or deny freedom while a case is pending or even after all appeals are exhausted and there are no appeals, at least on the substantive issues of the case that are remaining. This can be kind of an appeal of last resort.
And that starts the appellate process all over again. Once the trial judge makes a decision on habeas corpus, that decision can be appealed. And so there's at least a right to one appeal from the habeas corpus decision of the court. So it is a way to resurrect the case. That's going to happen on November 25th. Now, a hearing is scheduled for December 11th on the Menendez brothers case, and that is a motion filed by the defense and in conjunction with the LA County District Attorney, both of them asking for resentencing of the Menendez brothers. Now, as you recall, when I started this, we talked about them both being sentenced to two life sentences consecutive without parole. The prosecutor has come back and said, maybe we can resentence these young men. Both of them were under 26 years of age at the time of the sentencing. And so, therefore, let's change the sentence and make it 50 years to life instead of life sentence without parole. Let's change it up, 50 years to life. And because they were both under 26 under California law, they both would be immediately eligible for parole. So this process that I want us to delve into is a two-step process. One would be to have the court grant the motion for resentencing and, in fact, resentence the people, the brothers. And then two would be it would then go to the parole board for the parole board to decide whether they are given parole. That doesn't seem as strong as the habeas corpus. What do you think?
You know what? Well, two things. First, I kind of agree and disagree with the steps in the process. I think I would consider it more of a three-step process because even though the prosecution joined in the motion, it's the court that, well, first there's the motion. So that's step number one that is filed. Right. And of course, because there's a joint request, meaning a request from the defense and the prosecution, it requires the judge or the court to agree with it, to either have a hearing and to make a decision after the hearing, or to only read the briefs and the arguments that are made on paper and to make a decision based on those. But the process could stop after step number one, meaning right after the joint filing is sent to the court from the defense and the prosecution. If it proceeds to the next step, then that next step would be the court considering the information in the motions that's filed by the prosecution and the defense and deciding whether or not to agree with them and to grant the resentencing or to go ahead with the resentencing to do that. And if the court does that, could proceed all at the same time to the resentencing, knowing that the request for the resentencing would then make the defendants eligible for the parole hearing. Meaning, up until now, even given all the time that they've served in prison, they were and have not been eligible to even present themselves before a parole board to request any form of release from prison because of the sentence that they received. So for our listeners who've ever seen perhaps my favorite movie in the whole world is Shawshank Redemption. If you ever seen the Shawshank Redemption, you've probably seen Morgan Freeman as Red and every other actor there, Andy Dufresne, and all of the others go before the parole board and at some time or another were each granted parole, which is still a form of control or community control after you leave the institution, but you're just not detained or you're not institutionalized. You're not incarcerated in the prison itself, but you still have a requirement to report. You still may be subject to searches. You may be required to live in a certain environment like a halfway house or, to not go to certain neighborhoods. There are all kinds. You may be required to work. In this instance, if Eric and Lyle Menendez are granted this resentencing and are in fact resentenced, that does not automatically become their ticket to release from prison. As you said, Judge Tom, it then requires or gives them now the opportunity or ability to then ask the parole board to consider them for release from prison. And there are several factors that will be taken into consideration when that parole board decides, if it does, to consider their cases for early release from prison. Again, there's no sure thing, but as you said, Judge Tom, that this is the step that I think takes more effort than the habeas corpus, or even the third one that we'll talk about, which has nothing to do with the court at all. It actually comes from the authority of the executive branch, but we'll talk about that in a second. But this step means that the court only says, yes, you can ask the parole board for release on parole, and you'll see what they say, or if they respond, or if they say yes. I'll say yes, you can ask, because right now, no, you can't ask, and you don't have a sentence that allows you to ask. But I'll say yes, you can ask, and I'll give you a sentence that allows you to ask the parole board. But after that, the decision is in the hands of the parole board to decide if ultimately they say yes and that you should be released.
Well, the prosecutor in this case has filed a 57-page memo to the court supporting the resentencing of the Menendez brothers, saying all of the wonderful things that they've done while they've been in prison. Apparently, according to this 57-page report, they've been model prisoners. But even with that, the California Parole Board, I did a little research on this, they only grant 35% of the requests for parole that come before them. So if I were the Menendez brothers, I'd say, this is not a sure thing.
Even this isn't the gift re-sense. It looks like.
this is not a sure thing. You know, I'm not going to go out and plan my Christmas shopping, you know?
Yeah. It looks like a gift because you have the support of the prosecution, right? Who were the same right. folks responsible for helping or ensuring your incarceration. So it would seem that this is something substantial. But just as you said, when you look at the record of the parole board, it seems more likely than not that they deny requests for parole than grant them, almost at a, 3-to-1 ratio?
Yeah, 65% denial to 35% granting. So it's 2-to-1.
The odds don't look so good. 2-to-1 as opposed to 3. I'm a lawyer, not a mathematician, so 2-to-1. And either way, the odds don't look so good.
Okay, so let's further complicate this. Now we've got our audience, I hope, following us. We have a motion for habeas corpus. That's one way. That's November 25th hearing. We've got this December 11th hearing on the motion for resentencing. But what's happening on November 5th? There's an election.
Oh, it's election day.
And the Los Angeles County District Attorney, who has filed all this material, the 57-page memo in favor of the Menendez brothers, is currently running
for
30
office.
Points behind his challenger. Mm. And the challenger would be in office if the challenger wins, a guy by the name of Nathan Hochman. If Nathan Hochman wins, Nathan Hochman would be the district attorney on December 11th. So all bets could be off on that one.
This looks pretty ominous. It looks more and more ominous for
we started off like this is going to be a sure thing, right?
But you know what this looks like? This looks like a box of poop wrapped in really nice wrapping paper. This is a gift of poop.
Well, the habeas corpus looks like the best chance, and that's on November 25th. But again, that would just reverse the convictions and reopen the proceedings. And so then we've talked about the resentencing and the parole board. And now, no wonder, the attorneys for the Menendez brothers are making an all-out assault on Governor Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, to give, based on all of the arguments we've already talked about, to give clemency or a pardon to the Menendez brothers. So for our listeners, I want us to define the difference between clemency and a pardon.
Which one would you like, Judge?
Well, clemency, I think, is saying that I'm going to alter your sentence. As governor, I'm going to either give you a new trial or I'm going to release you for time served, but you're still convicted. You're still a convicted felon. You're still convicted of murder. We're not changing the outcome of the trial. Despite the new evidence that's been presented, the Menendo, did I say it right that time?
Menendez brothers.
No.
Is the group.
The brand. That's what I'm saying. Besides their testimony, in addition to their testimony and the letter, all of that, I'm going to give you clemency. I'm going to release you. That's different than pardon. You're still convicted. At a pardon? What's a pardon?
Well, that's yours. A pardon, a pardon is forgiveness by a governor, you generally by a governor, for a crime or an offense that's committed. So excusing. So if you say, I like to always try to create analogies in common parlance. So in this instance, if you are saying, you know, pardon me or excuse me or forgive me, those are often considered synonymous phrases. Well, if you are asking a governor for a pardon, you're asking for, you know, for an excuse or for forgiveness of a crime or an offense that's committed. And when or if you are pardoned by the governor, the trigger here is that generally you cannot be punished further for that particular offense. So once you're forgiven, you are forgiven. Once you are pardoned, you are pardoned free and clear. As you said, Tom, it is wiped clean. It is over. It is done. And you
not like we do with our spouses sometimes and forgive them for whatever. And then 2 months later, the next argument, bring up the same thing you forgave them for, right? That's not the case.
Right. And so it even could go as far as, you know, essentially not penalizing you with having a record of the offense going forward. Now, again, understand each state can design their own rules, but what you should know is the biggest trigger or the biggest linchpin is that when there is a pardon that is granted, when you are granted a pardon, then that pardon in and of itself cuts off the ability to impose any further penalties or punishment. Once you're pardoned, you are forgiven, your punishment is over, period.
So that's of the three options that we're looking at, that's obviously the best. a pardon would be the best. Clemency would be probably number two in my ranking. Mm-hmm. The habeas corpus, that might be three and four are really tough because the resentencing, you have to plan on what the parole board's going to do, and that's an unknown. And having your conviction reversed and reopen the proceedings with a potential new prosecutor, that's an unknown as well. So
Strategic on the part of the prosecutor is joining the resentencing as opposed to, because remember the prosecutor could have also joined the motion for habeas corpus.
Yeah, I think that was strategic on the part of the prosecutor. Mm-hmm. You know, and the judge, the reason the judge is having a hearing on both of these, but especially the resentencing, is so that he can hear from relatives and victims, and obviously not the two deceased, but other people who might object to the Menendez brothers being released. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a full-blown hearing. If it in fact goes forward.
I agree, especially given the timing of it. But I would also argue, Judge, that if the judge wanted to hold a hearing on the motion for habeas corpus, because it's a motion, the judge can do whatever they want. If they feel they're benefited by having more information and having, you know, more of a fuller appreciation or understanding of the situation, they could have done that for the habeas corpus. So
well,
it
is scheduled for a hearing for November 25th.
Yes, I agree with you in that, first of all, I think the clearest path to release would be the request to the governor for the pardon and then for clemency. Because, I think the pardon is the surest way to ensure that there's no further punishment. If the goal is to be released and there be no further imposition of punishment, no further detainment or incarceration, that the pardon is what accomplishes that most quickly, and followed by clemency, I would say between habeas corpus and you know, the motion for resentencing, that it's a crapshoot.
Both of those are crapshoots.
Yeah, and absolutely a toss-up. I don't know. In some regards, I kind of see them as just opposite sides of the same coin, if you will. Because if in fact, as you said before, if in fact the court grants the motion for habeas corpus, that essentially restarts the proceedings all over. You bear the possibility of re-traumatizing an awful lot of folks by going through this trial again.
And for the third time, because
there was, with now more information or more evidence, you just have a lot more unknowns, but you also increase the possibility of harm to more people by doing it again. Although you could achieve potentially the short-term goal of release while the matter's pending. It reminds me, and perhaps one day we'll address this case, is the case of Adnan Syed in Maryland, which was a very, very interesting case, somewhat similar with regard to the issue of release, and then whether or not the conviction was overturned. But even if you achieve the habeas corpus, you don't get finality. You don't get full resolution. And with the prosecution joining in, given the other side of this coin, the prosecution joining in on a motion to resentence, which again, I'm with you, I think this is strategic. This was designed this way on purpose by the prosecution in an election year where the incumbent is, you know, running at a deficit, which is pretty uncommon for incumbents.
30 points behind.
That's you might as well have a whole nother person in the race. If you're running at a 30-point deficit, that's a chunk of the electorate. But right. And again, it's uncommon for an incumbent to run that far behind in a reelection campaign. But that said, I think, again, there was some strategy to this. And in looking at this side of the coin, you still haven't achieved much because this is a multi-step process that is littered with a lot of ifs or a lot of if-thens. It's, if this motion gets granted, then this happens. And if this motion gets granted, then this happens. And if then you are able to go before the parole board, then this happens. And if they then say yes, then this happens. And if they say no, then you can potentially reapply. And so it seems like it's more of a decision tree than a direct decision that would provide them an avenue to release. And again, I'm talking from, the standpoint of defendants who are no doubt looking for the clearest path to release, as opposed to, perhaps the erection of more hurdles that would thwart their ability to be released or keep them from joining society again after they've served almost four decades behind bars.
So just so that our listeners understand, the habeas corpus petition that we're talking about, which would reverse the convictions and reopen the proceedings, that is a legal process that has legal standards that a judge would use on whether to grant that motion. The same thing with a motion for resentencing. It is a legal process that the judge has legal standards that he or she will be looking at in making that determination. Those two aspects, the motion for resentencing, the motion for habeas corpus, are legal processes. Now we get up to the request for clemency and pardon. Yes, it has an impact on the legal process, but those are political decisions by the governor. So,
and apparently by the prosecutor too.
Yeah. So your governor, what are you looking at here? What standards? There are no written standards. on whether you grant clemency or pardons. Hell, Trump gave them out like, you know.
Like Halloween candy. They were like Halloween candy provided to the most loyal among them.
Right, there are supposed to be standards, but they're not etched in stone. So, what's a governor?
Even some people who were not sufficiently loyal did not get pardons. So.
Sure. But in this case, what are the political considerations for a governor?
You know what? I think, first of all, that I think there are political considerations. I think there are community standards. I think there are, you know, personal considerations that governors, I would hope, would entertain in making these decisions. I would hope that chief among them, back to my favorite movie in the whole world, The Shawshank Redemption, I would hope that chief among the considerations is whether or not the individual has been appropriately rehabilitated during their term of incarceration. And that can be demonstrated in a lot of ways, including, you know, what they have been able to do with themselves during their time of incarceration. What have they done? What have they achieved? What have they developed a long record of disciplinary actions? Have they conversely not had any disciplinary actions and instead have been, you know, role models or, you know, peaceful and relatively, civilized individuals while in an incarcerated environment. But I think from a political standpoint, a governor has to consider the nature of the offense. How heinous was it? How harsh
Oh, this was heinous.
And agreed. But also whether or not there are mitigating circumstances and what those mitigating circumstances are and what the likely impact to the community is. And if we can just be really candid, having both gone through elections before, I think every politician is going to think about what is the backlash going to look like on me? If I do this, I need to war game this out. And
yeah,
because
this isn't a whodunit. Like. This is not a whodunit. They did
this was a we done it. This was a we done it.
Yeah, this is, am I going to release murderers back into the community? That's flat out what it is.
And let's also be really candid about this, and we can be transparent when we say, not only am I going to release murderers back out here to the community, what is the next cycle of political attack ads going to look like against me?
Exactly. Because if I run for president, I mean, Gavin Newsom's obviously been talked about as a potential candidate in the future.
Yes. You know,
what does this do to his political life?
If Gavin Newsom, you know, runs, he already survived a recall in California. But the question becomes, can you survive it again under these circumstances? Will you survive it if you're, you know, returning, if you're returning murderers back to the streets? The other thing is consider, because California is also a very, very diverse state. The Menendez brothers are, I believe they're minorities. Their father, Juan Menendez, they may not look like it on his face, but they are considered, I would think by all accounts, considered minorities. What is that? How is that going to resonate with other minority groups who may or may not feel like, hey, if that were us, would we get that same kind of treatment? What would it take what does it take for, you know, for my cousin Pookie to get the same kind of treatment?
As a media guy, I have to add, you know, we've had this recent Netflix docudrama. You know, what impact has that had? You know, your cousin Pookie is not going to have a docudrama. Probably.
Pookie going to barely get TikTok, okay? He's going to get a couple hits on TikTok, and he's going to get a mention here on Next Witness, Please. But Pookie's not getting Netflix type of cred. He's not getting that kind of exposure.
So the fact that you're responding to that kind of exposure, man, if I were in prison on any kind of major noteworthy public trial as this was back in the 90s, I'd be soliciting Netflix, Prime, Hulu, everybody, you know.
Well, yes,
come do something.
I mean, Yes. I mean, remember, gosh, what happened? The name escapes me. It was the attorney in South Carolina who was convicted of killing his wife and his son.
Yeah.
And it was the clerk of courts who actually struck a Netflix deal during the trial.
and almost overthrew the conviction. In fact, I think it's on appeal now.
Yeah, exactly. And so obviously Netflix has a deep and abiding interest in true crime. So
but
Alex
point,
Murdaugh, that's who it is. Alex Murdaugh.
The point is, though, that the governor would be responding more to public perception based on the Netflix docudrama than necessarily than the case itself. Yeah, because that's gonna impact the politics of his decision.
Not the
merits of the legal arguments. So this is going to be very interesting to watch. And while we're going through all the post-election litigation and trauma, this is going to be on a parallel path. The headlines I've read is Menendez brothers may be out by Christmas, but I don't know.
I don't know. That may be wishful thinking, or again, and you know this being a journalist, is that sometimes, journalists may put the cart before the horse without appreciating all of the requirements to make the wheels go round, right? So. Yeah. It's entirely possible, yes, that they could be enjoying Christmas at home or Christmas with family or the like. That's possible. But it's equally possible that, even were the stars to align with the judge and the court and they get yes, all the way up through into the time that they're seated before the parole board, the parole board's answer and response could be no. And so that could be the thing that actually stops them from ever seeing the other side of the doors at the prison. So it may be that they could be out. It may very well be that they're not. And I would not encourage anyone to merely bank on a headline, no more than we bank on the polling headlines we're seeing about the election, right? So
right.
I wouldn't bank on the headlines that we're seeing related to whether or not these young men or these men will be released, because as you said, and you've clearly and eloquently pointed out, Judge, there are just way too many steps involved. And even for the governor, there's way too much to consider. The implications are just way too much to consider. And I'll leave you with one final thought. So, there are some states where, holding people accountable and, even up to and including the point of execution is a badge of honor. And that is not California, but, take the state of Texas, and I'll never forget, Governor Kay Bailey Hutchison having a campaign commercial where she literally walks down a long hallway, and flanked on each side of the walls of the hallways are pictures of inmates in Texas prisons who are sitting on death row because she wanted to appear tough on crime. I could imagine the converse for a Governor Newsom with someone doing that and flanking walls with the pictures of individuals he's pardoned or he's released, and ending it with a tagline that, suggests that he's soft on crime and therefore none of us will be safe anywhere, and that he would be, not the optimal choice for a leader. And that has to be something that enters into the calculus of the mind of a skilled politician when they're making a decision like this.
And God forbid if he does release them or gives them pardons or give them clemency, and they get out and one of them or both of them go rogue.
They bet not jaywalk.
Rogue. And do something else. My God.
They better not take too many Snicker bars out of the Halloween candy bucket, because it will be all kinds of sideways for him, because no matter what they do, it's going to be made attributable to him. Absolutely. Is going to be a reflection of him. And he knows. He knows there's considerable risk related to this, right? It doesn't, if they are model inmates, you have to consider the fact that they're in a controlled environment. And so you can be a model inmate when somebody's telling you when to wake up, when to shower, when to eat, when to sleep, when to work out, you know, yep. when you can watch television. You can be a model anything. When we release you to society to have your own free will and you can, you know, you're turned loose on the rest of us, then you don't have those guardrails anymore. And no doubt, again, a smart and savvy politician like Governor Newsom is fully aware of that. And if these guys so much as get a ticket for jaywalking, it's going to be the governor's fault.
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch, and we'll keep you apprised at every step. We had somebody write to us and ask that we talk about habeas corpus. So we've checked that off the list. We've talked about habeas corpus today. So if you have any ideas for us that you'd like to know about or questions, you can just send them to me by my email address. That's hodson@ohio.edu. hodson@ohio.edu. And Judge Gale, they can find us a lot of places, but you give a good listing. So go right ahead.
Oh, yes. And we want to thank our listeners for checking us out on all of these platforms, which is how we know that we can respond to the things you want to know and learn about. And so thank you for listening. And please make sure you not only like us, but subscribe to Next Witness, Please. You can find us perhaps most easily and prominently on our most prominent and one of our favorite partners, which is National Public Radio, NPR, which has both national and international affiliations. You can also look for us any place you find your favorite podcasts. And so check us out on Amazon, Spotify, Apple, or as I say, any place where you find or you connect with your favorite podcasts, you can find us. Just look for the search tool, tap in NWP or Next Witness, Please. And there you will find us, where we encourage you to not just like us, but please subscribe, follow us, and share us with your friends and family. Because here's what we know. We know that you don't trust what you don't understand. And our goal is to increase your understanding of this sometimes challenging quagmire and maze of legalese, so that you will in turn trust us more. We thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing you and having you back with us soon.
Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media at Ohio University. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law and update you on the most recent cases. Have a good day, everyone.
I was waiting for the take care, folks.
Oh, take care, folks.